It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, our guest makes the case for antitrust action against the online retail giant Amazon.
First, President Trump returned to the Oval Office today, marking the end of his 17-day working vacation. It's his first day on the job without his chief strategist, Steve Bannon, who left the administration last Friday.
The Trump administration's policies post-Bannon already seem like they might be starting to take shape. The president is set to give a speech on Afghanistan and South Asia tonight. Many suspect he'll announce plans that Bannon would have disagreed with.
Rosie Gray is a staff writer at The Atlantic and joins us to take a closer look at what Trump administration policy without Steve Bannon could look like. Rosie, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
In broad strokes, what would you say the possibilities are for how different a Bannon-less White House might be?
Well, Steve Bannon kind of represented, the voice of Trump's base within the White House, and he was sort of the connection that President Trump had with his, with the sort of, populist slash nationalist ideology that has differentiated, Donald Trump from other Republicans. And within the White House, Steve Bannon was pushing for a lot of, campaign promises that they had made, such as renegotiating NAFTA, such as, basically trying to minimize our presence in Afghanistan. And there are other examples of that as well. And so, it's a very sort of factional White House, and Bannon was often opposed by more sort of moderate forces within the building who had a different point of view. And so with Bannon leaving, the White House loses sort of the key link to a lot of those sort of very, signature Trump initiatives.
So you said that Steve Bannon was seen as kind of the inside voice representing that really core Trump constituency. Do we know how that constituency, which has stayed very loyal to the president, is taking this news?
Well, if you look at Breitbart, which is the website that Steve Bannon was running before he joined the campaign and then the administration, and that he's actually returned now to be in charge of again, there's been some sort of pieces that are pretty critical of his kind of rivals from when he was in the White House, such as Jared and Ivanka and Gary Cohn and H.R. McMaster. And so, there was before when it seemed like his job was kind of in danger. I mean, there was definitely, a push on in sort of like pro-Trump media to kind of defend him, and especially with Breitbart and some other places. I would say that, the way that it's been received is as, Bannon kind of making, a sort of triumphant return to Breitbart. That's how they played it. But also, there's no question that his influence had been sort of minimized for a while, and that, he was at the end of the day, he was fired. So
the White House, the Trump administration, President Trump himself, has a low approval rating in the general population. Do you think this move to remove Steve Bannon might add a couple points to that approval rating?
Well, I'm not so sure that that most people necessarily are paying that close attention to the ins and outs of White House personnel changes. Yeah, I think that one thing that we could potentially see is that from the outside, Bannon is much more sort of, potentially influential on how Trump is received among the base than he might have been on the inside, because from the outside, Bannon is going to feel much freer to criticize Trump when he feels like he's not living up to promises, to go after people in the White House that he doesn't like. And so it's possible that if he uses Breitbart as his method of doing those things, Breitbart does have a substantial readership among the base, and that is something that could sway that sort of opinion.
We're talking right now with Rosie Gray. She's a staff writer at The Atlantic, and we're talking about what the Trump administration policy and the White House might look like without Steve Bannon, former chief strategist who left the administration on Friday. And Rosie, the president came under fire for his comments on Charlottesville and events there, and for having a chief strategist in Bannon that is strongly connected to the alt-right. Is this good news for the opposition? Are they taking this as a win?
Well, I'm not sure whether the opposition is necessarily taking this as a win. You know, I think that you see a lot of personnel churn in this White House. There are a lot of, you know, an unusual amount of senior White House officials who have either left or been fired just in the past, you know, couple months.
But he was certainly a lightning rod in a lot of ways.
Oh, definitely. And, you know, and there definitely was, you know, among the opposition, there was definitely a sentiment that Bannon needed to go. And I think that he could have maybe hung on longer if it hadn't been for Charlottesville and for the sort of, you know, like the sort of like added controversy that his presence in the White House sort of brought to that situation.
Do we know how much Steve Bannon's views were part of what President Trump said publicly on various occasions about race relations in the United States?
Do you mean over the course of the campaign or
in general? I mean, Bannon has been influential from the campaign through the election inauguration and up till Friday, at least. You know, how much did his position on race and his, you know, his views that were espoused on Breitbart, how much did those influence President Trump?
Well, I would say that, you know, it's some people sort of see Steve Bannon as a kind of, you know, Machiavellian, like power behind the throne sort of figure. And that's not quite right. I mean, you know, Donald Trump does have his own views and his own opinions about things. And I think that, you know, the idea that there's anybody working for him who can sort of really have a major impact on what comes out of his mouth isn't quite right. I do think that the two of them do tend to have kind of a mind meld on certain issues. And when it comes to race relations, you know, I think that they both have this instinct to, instead of doing what might be considered kind of like the politically correct thing, they have an instinct to, you know, even under intense criticism, sort of, you know, revert in the opposite direction and kind of lash out in that way.
The president will give a primetime speech tonight on Afghanistan and South Asia. People can hear that tonight on the Ideas Network. Could announcing more troops in Afghanistan mark a break with Bannon, since he was always against expending more U.S. forces around the world?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a good example of the White House sort of going in what might be kind of like the expected direction rather than the sort of Bannon direction. I mean, Bannon had been a big proponent of drawing down in Afghanistan and kind of minimizing U.S. presence there. And, you know, it's worth noting that Donald Trump himself has been a major critic of what's going on in Afghanistan and, you know, said during the campaign that he wanted to basically get out of there, et cetera. His generals, you know, like his military brass have basically encouraged him to, and they have come up with this plan that's expected to be announced that in which there's going to be a troop increase. Bannon had been, you know, bringing in outside people to sort of present plans that involved, for example, private contractors. Eric Prince, the former Blackwater president, you know, he drew up a plan that involved using contractors instead of U.S. troops, and that was something that was sort of circulating in the White House. And obviously, the Bannon point of view did not win out.
Rosie, as you said, there has been a lot of churn at the White House, many senior-level staff people coming and going. But, you know, Steve Bannon was different. I mean, he was with President Trump or candidate Trump first and before that and was an early supporter. You know, when Bannon talks about being able to be more effective for the president from the outside than from the inside, what happens if Bannon starts going after people close to President Trump? We know President Trump has a real issue with loyalty and protecting those close to him.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is a good question. I think, you know, if Steve Bannon sort of uses Breitbart to, like, heavily go after Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump, you know, I wonder, like, what the line would be before President Trump himself starts to not be so happy with that. But there is sort of a, there's been several instances in which, you know, somebody who kind of gets fired by Donald Trump sort of stays in the orbit and remains kind of like an outside advisor that they'll call on the phone and stuff like that. And I could see that. I could definitely see that happening with Steve Bannon, particularly since he's going to be running a news organization that, you know, that can be a very powerful ally of the White House, and that could be, if it turns on the White House, you know, a big sort of pain in the neck.
Rosie, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Rosie Gray is a staff writer at The Atlantic. She joined us to talk about the future of the Trump White House without former chief strategist Steve Bannon.
Right now, Amazon is a big company, no surprise there, but our next guest is worried that it's getting too big and has too much power to throw its weight around in whatever market it wants to get into.
He says regulators should consider antitrust action against Amazon, especially as it acquires more and more companies, including other online realtors, and now brick-and-mortar stores with the effort to buy Whole Foods Market.
Chris Sagers is a distinguished professor of law at Cleveland State University. He's the author of Apple, Antitrust and Irony, forthcoming from Harvard University Press. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, it's no secret that Amazon is big, but what is it that they're doing that you see as potentially leading to some kind of antitrust action?
Yeah, so could be two things, really. So Amazon has been very acquisitive. It has bought lots of other companies, and it's in the news lately as much as anything for its plan to acquire Whole Foods, which it's pretty interesting in itself. I'm sure we'll talk more about that. But that particular acquisition has gotten a lot of attention. Acquisitions can be illegal under the antitrust laws under certain circumstances. The other thing that I think could eventually land Amazon in trouble is it's gotten big very fast. And that in and of itself is not illegal under the antitrust laws. You can be as big as you want. You can even be a monopolist under U.S. antitrust law, so long as you don't get that position through what the law refers to as exclusionary conduct. But there's sort of an emerging record now of evidence that Amazon has engaged in conduct that at least in principle could be found to be exclusionary. So the short version of the answer is there are two things I could see as potential legal actions against Amazon. One is a challenge to an acquisition or some pattern of acquisitions, and the other is monopolization under the Sherman Act.
Yeah, well, usually when I think of monopolies and antitrust, I would think if my grocery store bought out your grocery store and we had this such a huge position in some markets, that would be a monopoly. It seems like what's happening here is when Amazon buys a grocery store chain or whatever, they have so much leverage with their online status and network and their distribution centers that gives them this huge advantage over other companies in whatever sector they want to get into. Is that part of the issue here?
Yeah, that's what I see. I mean, it's complicated, but the simple version of the monopolization story in my mind might go something like this. So Amazon, the company itself, of course, and its many defenders say, look, the firm hasn't done anything except charge low prices. It's gotten very big by charging low prices, and that is indeed true. And that in and of itself it's not illegal. And after all, it's the thing that the antitrust laws are supposed to encourage. But a theory that is a perfectly legitimate theory of antitrust liability is that, you know, maybe Amazon is getting big and funding this very low pricing by squeezing its suppliers. In other words, in technical terms, Amazon has gotten big and it has made itself not a monopolist, but a monopsonist. Monopsony claims aren't very common, but monopsony violates the antitrust laws just like monopoly if you get it through exclusionary conduct. And there is a case to be made, I think, that Amazon has gotten this monopsony position through exclusionary conduct. And it could be, as you say, that Amazon has made itself sort of the indispensable distributor for suppliers. As you say, Amazon has given itself this huge range of selection for consumers, and a seller can't afford to be without Amazon as its distributor. Again, saying that that's illegal is a lot harder than it sounds. If the government, for example, were to challenge Amazon as a monopsonist and try to argue that the company has acquired its monopsony position illegally, the government would have to put on a big case, a fact-intense case that's difficult to make, showing that through specific conduct, Amazon took that position unfairly. Specific kinds of conduct that could be exclusionary could include acquisitions, like you say, like Amazon has sort of very carefully picked firms to acquire in which, you know, any individual acquisition may not have seemed like such a big deal, but in the pattern of them may have given rise to an opportunity position. Amazon has done a bunch of other stuff, though. And, you know, it's detailed. We could go on and on about it. But in short, its critics say that Amazon has used its advantage over data. Amazon has a huge amount of data and various other advantages to squeeze third-party competitors out of the marketplace. And that's the kind of thing that can give rise to a lawsuit.
Talking to Chris Sagers, law professor at Cleveland State University, about Amazon and possible antitrust action. Let's talk about how this would work, Chris. Who would have to take antitrust action if somebody were interested in doing so?
Yeah, so the federal government obviously can do it. The state governments also are entitled to enforce the antitrust laws, and then private persons could. The kind of private persons you could imagine suing Amazon for monopsony might be its suppliers or possibly other retailers. I think if there is going to be an antitrust lawsuit that actually works, has any real chance of succeeding, it probably would be a federal government action. There is a case in not too distant history that seems to me pretty similar, and that was the Justice Department's monopolization claim against Microsoft about 15 years ago. It was a big deal. The government said that Microsoft monopolized the market for computer operating systems, and the government actually won. And the kind of case that the government put on there is the kind of case I could imagine happening here. The government took a long time, used its sort of massive investigatory powers, and figured out just a whole bunch of little hidden things that Microsoft had done to hamstring its rivals and make sure that it kept that operating system position. I think who knows what the government would find if it actually starts looking, but if it does, the government might find a case kind of like that against Amazon.
Now, if I'm a consumer, maybe an Amazon customer, I like the prices, I like the quick delivery, I get stuff I need, I get some stuff I don't need. If I look at this and say, what's in this for me? Why would I be worried about Amazon's market power if I'm currently benefiting from it?
Yeah, right. That's a good question. It's a good question, and it's the answer, I think, is that to Joe Consumer, which obviously includes me and you, there may not be that much immediately in it for us. Like, you're not going to see an antitrust lawsuit causing you to have lower prices or continued access to great service, which we already have with Amazon. So the social harm of this monopsony is that the damage it does to suppliers probably is fairly serious on a social level. Like, it isn't just those suppliers that are getting hurt. It's damage to the availability of high-quality products and the incentive on the part of suppliers and so on to innovate. It's also potentially damage in labor markets for people who work for those suppliers. It's a lot of stuff. The economics community, economists, are pretty much in agreement that where monopsony exists, it's just as harmful to society as monopoly, and it ought to be stopped for similar reasons.
A big question, but maybe you could sum it up. What is the goal of having antitrust laws in place? Why do we have them?
Yeah, so very good question, and there's more than one answer. The immediate answer is to keep prices low and consumer choice high. But more significantly, competitive markets produce goods more efficiently than non-competitive markets, which sounds like, I don't know, sounds kind of dry, sounds kind of not very sexy, but in fact it's incredibly sexy, because when markets overall, the economy overall, is more efficient than not, that means there's more resources left over for everything else. It improves the standard of living. It potentially improves income distribution, like wealth distribution is better if markets are more competitive overall. An aggressive antitrust enforcement program, if it works, has really big picture social benefits, and it is a lot more significant than just cheaper widgets down at Target.
And Chris, as we wrap up, I want to ask you to predict the future and how and if antitrust action might be taken here. But as it currently exists, is our antitrust enforcement mechanism ready to deal with a question like Amazon?
Yeah, maybe not. I mean, there's a lot of talk about this. You can find a lot of debate about Amazon suggesting that there's something wrong with the antitrust laws as they exist. I happen to think that's quite incorrect. There is a problem in antitrust now, if you ask me, and that is largely a problem of popular support. I think, it's hard to understand how the antitrust laws work, what they're even supposed to accomplish, and that hurts in antitrust enforcement, above all because it sort of saps the willingness to enforce the laws on behalf of our courts. So, for example, the biggest problem in bringing a case against Amazon is going to be convincing the courts that there's been a violation of the law. The courts have made it extremely difficult. The answer to your question, I think, is the problem with bringing a suit against Amazon is not that the rules don't exist to control the problems that Amazon poses. It's that it's really difficult to convince the courts to believe it. It's difficult to convince federal enforcement officials to have the guts to bring the case. So that's how I see it. My guess is it's hard to imagine the Trump administration bringing a case like this, but I wouldn't be surprised if within the next 10 years or so there is some kind of really major antitrust action, either against Amazon or one of the other big platform companies like Facebook or Google.
Chris, thanks a lot for joining us today.
That's my pleasure. Thank you.
That was Chris Sagers, law professor at Cleveland State University, talking about possible antitrust action against the company Amazon. Many people took to the road this weekend to get closer to the line of full totality for today's great American solar eclipse. Some traveled alone or with friends and family. Some went with an organized group.
One of those groups was coordinated by the Milwaukee Public Museum and was led by Bob Bonadour, the director of the museum's planetarium. Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Meg Jones went along and joins us now from Metropolis, Illinois. Meg, thanks for taking time to talk with us.
Hey, my pleasure. I'm still kind of the awe and the aura of seeing the totality, the eclipse totality. It was very cool.
Well, yeah. So what was it like?
So the group from the Milwaukee Public Museum is 110 people, and they had four different sites, three sites in Missouri, one site in southern Illinois, just to kind of hedge their bets, because if it's cloudy or it's raining, it'd be like the effect of, like, pulling a dark curtain across the sky and you wouldn't be able to see it. But so they ended up choosing Metropolis, Illinois, and we're right on the Ohio River. In fact, you can look right across the river and see into Kentucky. And in this area, they got 2 minutes and 23 seconds of totality. And there were some clouds that came out, and sometimes we couldn't see the eclipse as it was happening because the clouds were going by. But for those 2.5 minutes, the clouds just seemed to part. Maybe it was angels singing that we heard, sure. But and then it was fun because Bob, they had a bunch of telescopes with the solar filters and binoculars and solar filters and things set up. But Bob was shouting at, 5 minutes, 3 minutes, and then he was, everyone's wearing their eclipse glasses. And then he goes, get ready. And then all of a sudden, we saw what's called the diamond ring. So basically, you see, like, the golden corona around the sun, but there's a little dab of light that's shining through, so it kind of looks like a blazing diamond ring. Hmm. And what was interesting is that where we're set up, we're at Fort Maverick State Park, there's a Sonic drive-in, one of those ice cream places across the way. Mm-hmm. Well, the lights turned on a Sonic drive-in because, they sensed that it was night, and then the crickets were chirping, and then somebody said, hey, there's Venus. So there was so much to kind of take in, but it was just really, really cool.
Well, Meg, we saw the partial eclipse here. It was neat, but nowhere near as cool. And we could be bitter and resentful at those who got to see it, but instead we're going to live vicariously through you and the people you were with. What kind of reaction did this crowd of 100-plus people with the Milwaukee Public Museum, what was the reaction when the diamond ring came out?
a lot of the people were rookies, like myself, who had never, ever seen a total solar eclipse. So you know, like most of us had read about it. We'd listened to lectures and stuff. But still, it wasn't – I talked to some people, and they're like, wow, I knew it was coming, and yet I couldn't believe what was happening. One lady said, the sun was black. We had a black sun. So there was everything from hooting and hollering and cheering to some people just, like, their jaws are dropped. There was a few people that were trying to take pictures. It was just really, really cool. So I talked to quite a few people, and from what I understand is that, you know, they're kind of like potato chips. You just can't have one. So I talked to some people, and they're like, hey, maybe we'll go to South America in 2019 or 2020. And they said, or just wait until 2024 when the solar eclipse comes through America again. And one interesting fact, I happen to be in Metropolis, Illinois, where people, all they just had to do is look out the window. And in 2024, that's all they have to do again is look out the window. So the eclipse is going to hit this part of the United States twice in 7 years, and these folks just do not know how lucky they are.
So, you know, places like Metropolis, Illinois, but also larger places like St. Louis and other places that mm-hmm. were in that path, did you notice a lot of, how would we say it, eclipse tourism-oriented marketing going on? Were people taking advantage of this?
Try the eclipse burger.
Yeah. Yes, definitely. I'm still writing my story right now, but as soon as I finish, I'm going to go into Metropolis, and they're having a solar eclipse festival. So they're having street vendors, and I'm going to go to the Superman Museum because they've got this huge Superman, because, you know, Metropolis is the home of Superman, and they've got this huge Superman statue that everyone gets their picture taken up, which I plan to do once I'm no longer working or finished with my work. But everybody's getting on the bandwagon. And it was so funny last night. I finished work at 10 p.m. and I got in my car and I drove overnight. It's about a 7-hour drive from Milwaukee down to Metropolis. And so I'm stopping in Highway 54 in Illinois, and I'm stopping at, like, the rest stops at 2 a.m., and they're packed. It was like a concert had just let out. I mean, there's all these people that were out and about moving around, and you just kind of look at each other and, like, yep, we could chase her. We're all out for the same reason.
We're talking with Meg Jones right now. She is a reporter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and she traveled to, it ends up, Southern Illinois with a group of eclipse watchers organized by the Milwaukee Public Museum.
And you said you had the telescopes there with the sun filters. What was it like? Did you get a chance to look through that yourself, Meg?
Yeah, so that was really cool because we could see sunspots. So I could see 3 sunspots on the sun,
wow,
which apparently the way Bob Benatar, the planetarium director, is describing it, each one of those dots, each one of those sunspots is larger than Earth. Huh. So, but there are these little tiny pinpricks. And so that was fascinating. And the sun looked, depending on the type of filter, it was like this bright red, kind of a blood orange, to just a very bright yellow, orange. It was just so cool. And what was also neat was that people brought, like, colanders, and they made, like, pinhole signs, and they would hold that up to the sun and then shine it down on a white fabric, and you could see the shadows, the tiny shadows were crescent shaped. As the crescent sun was shining down. So that was really, really kind of cool, something I hadn't quite expected.
Well, and we had a range of gadgets here at WPR. A bunch of us went outside. Rob, co-host here,
I scored some glasses.
He actually had some glasses, so we were all being nicer to Rob than we usually are. but then one of our reporters, Bridget Bowden, had made a pinhole viewer with a, what do you call it, like the box that, like, a 12-pack of Klarburn water comes in, a very Wisconsin one, since it was in the Klarburn. And other people I saw had, you know, the piece of cardboard with the pinhole and were reflecting. So we had a little bit of everything here, and it sounds like you did too.
Yeah, it was neat. I wouldn't have thought, and it was funny because people would make these pinhole things, but they would spell out things. So they would say, like, in the pinholes, they would say, like, MPM Eclipse Trip 2017, or Original Sunscreen, or Science Rules. And, of course, the Science Rules is a science teacher. I talked to actually a lot of science teachers that were here today. And in fact, I talked to a retired Nicolet high school science teacher. She had never seen a total solar eclipse. And she's like, I taught these for years. I could explain to my students what how they work, what happens. But she said, finally, I get a chance to actually see one. So she was pretty excited. And there was planetarium directors, astronomy nerds, people like myself were just kind of into it. So it was kind of an interesting, eclectic group of people that came with the Milwaukee Public Museum.
And you said some of the people with you were talking about trying to catch another eclipse. Meg, is this on your agenda now to try to get to another and another and another?
Oh, you bet. You bet. I was doing Facebook Live beforehand, and then I stopped about maybe 10 minutes beforehand because I didn't want to like bother people. And of course, I just wanted experience. And as the shadow came over, and as we saw the diamond ring, and then we just stood and looked at it, I just literally went out like, "Oh my gosh!" it's kind of hard to explain. And then immediately I'm thinking, "Oh, I got to see this again. I have got to see this again." So yeah, whether I'm going someplace South America in 2019, there is no solar eclipse anywhere on the planet next year in 2018. We've got to wait until 2019. But definitely, a friend of mine lives in the Path in Ohio in 2024, and I wrote her a letter last week and I said, "Hey, you know, put me on your calendar."
A lot of people in the Southern Midwest are reconnecting with their friends they'd forgotten about.
Yes.
I bet.
Yeah. But have missed terribly all these years. Well, Meg, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate you taking the time.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Thank you.
Meg Jones is a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She traveled to Southern Illinois with a group of eclipse watchers that was organized by the Milwaukee Public Museum.
Now, if you think about the religious significance of events like a total solar eclipse, you might think back to the ancient Mayans and others who didn't have the scientific knowledge and technology to understand what was happening and why.
But it's not just ancient religious beliefs that assign significance to these astronomical events. There are also some people today who see both natural and man-made occurrences as important signs of approaching end times.
For example, a Christian prophecy website called Unsealed says that while today's eclipse is not a definitive sign to the start of the so-called tribulation, a seven-year period in which 75% of the world's population would be destroyed, it could be a sign that that period is drawing near.
Michael Altman is an assistant professor in the University of Alabama's Department of Religious Studies and is a scholar of religion in American history and culture. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So what are the earliest references that we have to people trying to make sense of natural phenomena and deciding that they must be signs from the gods or God?
We see early signs of this across, you know, ancient cultures, whether it's in the sort of Indus Valley or Mesopotamia, where some of the earliest stories, earliest myths about the gods connect the gods to natural events, natural phenomena, natural bodies, and so it's really been kind of from the infancy of sort of human cultures. There's been some sort of connection and some attempt to make meaning out of the natural world, especially the sort of more amazing aspects of the natural world, by people all over the place.
And what were some of those interpretations? When you say they were trying to make sense of these events, what sense did they make of them?
Well, I mean, I think one way to understand sort of ancient mythology, whether it's across different, you know, cultures and ancient times, is to think about them as stories that try to explain the natural world. Like, this has been an ongoing theory among people with an interest in myth since the sort of birth of the study of comparative religion. And the idea being that these natural events, they need explanations. And people want to find some sort of explanation or meaning for them. There's the famous, I don't know how famous, but there's a British anthropologist named Edward Tyler. And he had a whole theory about how human beings used religion as a kind of early science. His colleague later on, another old dead European named James Frazer, had a similar idea that religion was kind of an early science, and so these stories about the gods were explanations for things that in the 19th century they thought would eventually be explained more rationally.
And it seems like thinking about things like eclipses, part of what was probably very terrifying and would have such an impact on these cultures is that they weren't predictable for them. They wouldn't know when they were coming, and then all of a sudden this dramatic event would happen. Were there other natural events that might also seem so random that they would focus in on as possible signs of something that the gods wanted them to know?
Yeah, I mean, floods and earthquakes come immediately to mind. Like, flood stories are something you see across ancient cultures, and earthquakes, similarly, these things that seem sort of unexpected. Even as it doesn't have to just be ancient. There's a story of in New England in the colonial period when these New England Puritans, and there was an earthquake, and then many of them thought it was either the second coming of Jesus or it was punishment for them not being good Puritans. Hmm. So it's something that these sort of natural events, and we see that even famously. After Katrina, there were religious leaders who came out and said this was punishment for American sins of various sorts. So there's an ongoing, people want to find some sort of meaning in these events oftentimes. And what I find fascinating as a historian is who wants to find what meanings when, because mm-hmm. not everyone agrees on the meanings. Not everyone thinks things are meaningful. And there's a lot of ways that you can see in the claims about what a natural event means really reflect sort of underlying social conflicts or cultural arguments that are happening.
I can totally see why earthquakes and floods would also fit into that, but it does seem like there's something about the sky and the heavens, and I'm wondering, were things like comets or shooting stars also in that category?
Oh yeah, for sure. And a lot of cultures have developed sophisticated ways of tracking the way the heavens move and stars and organizing religious rituals around, whether it's the lunar calendar or various movements of the stars. And so there's a way that it's not just that the sort of the more, eclipses and shooting stars that carry huge meanings, but in general, a lot of times the stars have functioned as a kind of map for ritual. Or a way of making sense of time, again that can be ancient and it can be modern. In 1997, in California, the I think about the Heaven's Gate mm-hmm. community, that when the Hale-Bopp comet came across, they believed that they were going to be taken off to heaven, to a new realm, to a higher plane, on the tail of that comet, and they were committed a mass suicide. Oddly enough, the leader of that group was at University of Alabama very, very briefly. Mm. So it's not it's not just an ancient thing, which I think is important to note. Like, we think we've shaken this. I think a lot of people think that we've sort of shaken off. We're outgrown this. We've left it behind. Science is going to explain everything. But I saw plenty of people standing in a large group staring at the sky, which if we sort of brought back somebody from an ancient culture, would say, yeah, that's what we'd do too if we had an eclipse. We'd all stand outside together and stare at the sky. So,
Michael Altman is an assistant professor in the University of Alabama's Department of Religious Studies and a scholar of religion in American history and culture. And we're talking about the significance that's assigned to natural phenomena and some man-made phenomena, too, in terms of the end times. And so let's turn to that, Michael. When did those beliefs turn towards signs of a coming apocalypse or the beginning of the end for humanity?
Well, I think it's important to note, like, the idea of apocalypse. Various cultures have ideas of the destruction of the world and the at various moments. So, for example, in India, there is a whole notion of the world is created, it's sustained, it's destroyed, and then it's recreated. You see the same thing in a lot of Native American traditions, a kind of cyclical view. But the idea of an apocalypse, a big ending, a kind of linear view of time, that was something that really emerges out of the rise of Christianity in the West. And the idea that the end of this time is coming near is something that's as old as Christianity. I mean, if you look at the New Testament, the early Christian writer, the Apostle Paul, many times in his writing you see where he thinks, like, Jesus is coming back and the last days are very near in his lifetime. And here we are, 2,000 years later, and Christians still think that the, you know, the end times are near in many ways. And so I think that there's something about Christianity and its expansion through Europe and then through sort of European empire in the 19th century and into modernity, where we've the thing that's really stuck with us, even people who aren't Christians, is that linear sense of time. That time is going ahead towards some end, whether that end is an eclipse and an apocalypse, or maybe something like the destruction of the world via something like global warming. But that linear thing has been with us since then.
And besides signs like, for instance, a complete eclipse and these other natural phenomena that we talked about, there are also a lot of signs and predictions that people that hold these beliefs assign to many events happening in the state of Israel,
yeah,
and in the Middle East, but then also other signs that they assign a lot of meaning to. It seems like there are a lot of these signs and symbols that people who hold these views are very tuned into that the rest of the population is really ignorant of. Is that a problem?
I don't think it's a problem. Well, I think it might be a problem at the level of sort of personal self-care. Like if you're walking around worried about the end of the world all the time, that's going to be detrimental to you. I don't think it poses a large sort of social or cultural problem. But what's interesting, I think, are the moments that it pops up into the larger mainstream and the ways. So I think the questions about the state of Israel has been something that has functioned politically to hold a lot of more conservative Protestants, if we want to call them evangelicals, a little closer to, say, the Republican Party. Right. It's one issue. There's plenty. But there's ways that this stuff enters the mainstream that it then becomes something we have to think about and talk about. And, you know, I don't think that, small fringe groups who are expecting the end times today with this apocalypse are necessarily a problem. But I think they do reflect a sort of more general anxiety in American society right now. Claims about the end times being near tend to arise, if you look at them historically, in moments of sort of social distress or social conflict. They're a kind of symptom, I think, in many ways, of larger sort of social anxieties.
And Michael, we have just about a minute left, yeah, but I wanted to ask you if there are cultures or faiths that have taken either a positive view of events like these as signs, or at least not seen them quite so much as reason for fear.
Yeah, I mean, there's plenty of folks who see these things can see events like this as auspicious, and as, you know, build rituals around them specifically because they're supposed to be, you know, more sacred or more powerful, or we have closer access to the divine. So they don't have to be negative at all. And I think one thing I've noticed is I saw, for example, about an hour ago, Lindsey Graham, the senator from South Carolina, who I guess South Carolina was in the path of the full eclipse, tweeted something about the eclipse and then said, you know, thank you, God, or something to that effect. And there was a way that his reading as a Christian of the eclipse was as a statement of sort of the awesomeness of God's creation.
And we'll have to leave it there. Michael, thank you so much for joining us. Michael Altman is a assistant professor of religious studies at University of Alabama. He joined us to talk about the significance that is given to natural events like an eclipse.
On Friday, we asked you to share some of your favorite foods that you love and that the people around you, friends and family, say hate. Mine, for example, were things like beets and sauerkraut. And Judith, I imagine you've got one or two.
Okay, I totally coincidentally had an experience right here at work today that proved this. I had just eaten smoked sardines, and I was actually on the way to wash my hands, but had to stop in our producer's office. And as I was leaving, someone said, "Somebody smell fish?" So apparently, little did I know, smoked sardines, fit on that. At home, it's Sloppy Joe's. My husband really doesn't like them and doesn't like the smell of them.
Well, we've got ours, and you shared some of yours as well over on the Central Time Facebook page.
Lots of liver and onion fans. Got to say, I'm right there with you. I love it. Carla says she goes for liver and onions and bacon, which is how my mother used to make it. And Chris writes, one of my favorite winter meals is liver and onions with new potatoes and a spinach salad with hot bacon dressing. I invited a friend over for dinner, and he told me in advance he wouldn't eat it. I said, you've never eaten my liver and onions. He ate and told me it was the best meal he ever had.
Chris also gave us a recipe and says the Central Time team should try it along with some beets and some good red Zinfandel.
Yes. And Tracy said grape jelly on her grilled cheese sandwich.
Yuck. And Linda adds fried okra, among other things on her list. A fan of okra myself. I'm the only one in my house who eats that too. So a lot of good ideas. Thank you. Keep sharing at Central Time WPR on Twitter or on the Central Time Facebook page.